The House comes to oral questions. Question number one, Kiritapu Allen.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Associate Minister of Education. What announcements has he made as part of the wellbeing budget that support kohanga reo, their teachers, volunteers, tamariki and whānau?
The Honourable Kelvin Davis.
Mr. Speaker. Good news, Mr. Speaker. Last week we announced that kohanga reo will receive $32 million in funding boost to lift wages, pay volunteers and improve and upgrade facilities. This announcement was more, it was about more than just funding. It was a long overdue thank you to the kaiako, the kaimahi, the nannies, the aunties, the mothers, fathers and cousins whose commitment to kohanga reo never faltered. This announcement shows our commitment to them and is just the start of the work we'll do together to achieve our shared aspirations.
Supplementary, sir. How will the funding be distributed?
Through Budget 2019, we'll be looking after the wellbeing of our kohanga reo by providing $11 million for improvements to ICT capacity and capability and building upgrades, and over $21 million to increase existing pay rates for kaiako and kaimahi to the government's stated 2021 minimum wage rate, maintain a level of existing relative pay rates for kaiako and kaimahi.
Staff and teachers.
Kaimahi currently work
and teachers
in roles that would normally be remunerated. That is a total of just over $32 million for our kohanga, our kaiako, our kaimahi.
Teachers and staff. Children.
Supplementary, sir. What has been the reaction to the government's investment in kohanga reo?
Mr. Speaker, the response has been humbling, not just because of the recognition that this funding gives to kaimahi and kaiako, but because this government recognises kohanga reo are not early learning child, early childhood centres, nor are they kindergartens. They should not have to fit a mould designed for non-Māori organisations. They are kohanga reo, unapologetically Māori. They do not need to be compared to something else to gain recognition, because there is nothing else that can compare. And as Waihoroi Shortland said at the announcement, quote, tears come easy when the kaupapa is treated so well, unquote. He also said in Māori, ko rangatira tēnei rai, quote,
We are honoured by this occasion on this late, and we heard your sentiments this morning, and we can bring together these sorts of initiatives around the country and walking through the Māori world.
Question number two, the Honourable Simon Bridges.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all her government's statements and actions in relation to the alleged unauthorised access of Budget 2019 material?
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes. Particularly the comments made by the Deputy Prime Minister in relation to the ethics and legality of the opposition's unauthorised access of the Treasury site.
Does she stand by her Deputy Prime Minister's statement that every budget figure released by National prior to the budget was, quote, utterly fake, false, and will be proven so on Thursday?
He didn't say that.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister did not say that. What he did was produce a press statement 2 Tuesdays ago from that man's office, on which there were 8 calculations, 7 of which were then and now demonstrably wrong.
Does she stand by her Deputy Prime Minister's statement in regard to the same accessing of budget material that, quote, the facts are very, very bad for the National Party?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I rush to stand by the Deputy Prime Minister's comments, because he has now got the very document put out by Simon Bridges' office, and 8 of these 8 calculations, 7 are wrong. All right?
Supplementary. What? No.
Supplementary. Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What reported comments has she seen regarding the alleged unauthorised access of Budget 2019 material?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, a number of commentators have determined that what Mr. Bridges did had these features. There are some pretty good arguments that one of or more of the provisions of the Crimes Act were breached. The implication that there was... Forget about that Woodward teacher. He wouldn't understand the law.
Order.
Well, are you going to keep on shouting?
No, the member will sit down.
Can I say that to the Honourable Gerry Brownlee that this is a serious matter? His leader thinks it's a serious matter. There isn't a. I've asked people in the House to try and treat it seriously, and his interjections, I think, based on about as much legal training as I've had, are not helpful. A point of order of the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, recognising your chastisement, I withdraw and apologise for any offence I've called the House. I just hope that the Prime Minister treats the question as seriously as the Leader of the Opposition.
Well, I'm trying to get him to do that. The Member's not helping.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, these comments are very apposite. Quotes, there are some pretty good arguments that one or more provisions of the Crimes Act were breached. The implication that there was clearly nothing criminal in the activity is difficult to square with the statutory language. That from a leading law professor.
Did member nations of Five Eyes contact the government on Tuesday, 28 May, in relation to the government's claim they had been systematically and deliberately hacked?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I personally can't answer that question because I'm not aware of it.
Is that because some members of her government, quite possibly including the Deputy Prime Minister, were out of the loop?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, no one in this cabinet's out of the loop. Consultation is our middle name. But the reality is, in April of 2017, a cabinet minister created the Cybersecurity One-Stop Shop, otherwise known as CERT, Computer Emergency Response Team, which cost $22 million to establish, and those protocols under the CERT were designed for reporting the type of data breach that occurred and accompanied the unauthorised budget information accessed by the National Party spokesman staffer in this case. Mr Bridges, you wrote the rules. Abide by them.
Did the GCSB raise with the government that Five Eyes members had raised concerns regarding the systematic and deliberate hack?
Again, on behalf of the Prime Minister, that is not a question we can answer because there seems to be information that is coming into the government.
Order. The member will resume his seat. Nick Smith, this is a very serious matter. It goes to both security and international relations, and the House wants to hear it without that sort of inane interjection.
On behalf of the Prime Minister, there seems to be allegations coming from the opposition, rather, which do not have any, authorisation with respect to a possible leak. But that's immaterial. What the protocol that was established by Mr Bridges said was, and I quote, when private and confidential information is released...
Order. I am going to interrupt the acting Prime Minister or the Minister acting for the Prime Minister now because the question that has been asked has been answered and this is extraneous material which is not related to the supplementary question.
Isn't it the case that as soon as statements from Treasury and Grant Robertson went out Tuesday night alleging systematic and deliberate hacks, Five Eyes members contacted the GCSB, who then immediately got in touch with Andrew Little and his office?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I am not aware of that, but I do not think that Five Eyes were struggling over themselves on a matter to do with Treasury. With the greater respect, it's not foreign policy, it's not police, it's not defence, it's not customs, it's Treasury, and I find it very hard to believe that. But what's important, of course, is the protocol established by Mr Bridges required him to do the following.
Order.
Advise
order,
the organised...
Order, order, order.
Is he aware, no, is she aware, that the government through GCSB provided assurances to Five Eyes members that they had not been systematically and deliberately hacked?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, the GCSB could not give such an assurance. On behalf of the government, it would be for the Prime Minister, or in this case, Mr. Little, the acting minister for the GCSB, to give such an assurance. That's how responsibility works under this government.
Is the Prime Minister aware that language such as systematic and deliberate hacking is often reserved by governments for hostile foreign attacks?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, no, we're not aware of that. But the real issue is this. If the National Party hadn't done what it did, this would not be an event.
In addition to GCSB, did the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade also become involved in providing assurances to Five Eyes members that the government had not been systematically and deliberately hacked?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, this is getting more closer to the area of responsibility of the person answering the question right now. And the answer is no. But the real issue will never be... The issue won't change. This so-called scandal would not exist if the National Party hadn't done what it did.
Order. No, before the member, the Deputy Leader of the Opposition will stand, withdraw and apologise.
I stand and withdraw and apologise.
Well, actually, you'll just do what you're meant to do.
I withdraw and apologise.
Thank you.
Isn't it most certainly the case that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade did become involved in this? And is it also the case that the Minister didn't even know?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, there is no way that such an involvement of Foreign Affairs would have happened without the Minister of Foreign Affairs knowing. Being asleep behind the wheel is not what the present Foreign Minister does.
When did, to the Prime Minister's knowledge, the Deputy Prime Minister get informed it wasn't a systematic and deliberate hack?
I didn't hear that question clearly.
Would the speaker speak? Yeah,
no, ask it again.
Thank you. To the Prime Minister's understanding, when did the Deputy Prime Minister get informed it wasn't a systematic and deliberate hack?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, when referring to the Deputy Prime Minister, that is a very moot point. There are two sections of the Crimes Act which are very, very concerning for that member over there.
The Honourable Tracy Martin.
I'm
going to go back.
I'm going to rule on that.
I won't rule on the extraneous material, but there was a specific question which I know that the Minister answering on behalf of the Prime Minister should be able to answer. Let's ask it again.
When did the Deputy Prime Minister get informed it wasn't a systematic and deliberate hack?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, that remains a moot point, which is the reason why there's a State Services Commission inquiry.
The Honourable Tracy Martin.
No, sorry.
The point of order from the Honourable Jeremy Browning.
Mr. Speaker, if a minister is going to give an answer in this House, particularly the Prime Minister giving an answer in this House, then the provision that it should be done so in the public interest, as set down in the standing orders, is going to be of most importance. Everyone knows that the question that the Deputy Prime Minister acting for the Prime Minister has just put to the House cannot ever be answered by the State Services Commission inquiry because of the very limited terms of reference that are well published. Now, if someone would like me to table those terms of reference,
I think I can deal with that relatively easily if it is a relevant matter to that inquiry, and it might well be. The timing of member staff, timing of departments, including in this case Foreign Affairs,
giving information to the Deputy Prime Minister is most it's the giving and not the receipt is certainly covered by the inquiry.
Speaking the point of order. Mr. Speaker, there is no question of there being any investigation into matters that might be considered under the Crimes Act, as the Prime Minister has just told the House. So either the Prime Minister doesn't know what the terms of reference are, and I'd be happy to table them for her, or the Deputy Prime Minister has not been told what the terms of reference are. Either way, this House should not be given a brush off with what is a totally incorrect answer.
Speaking to the point of the Honourable Chris.
I think it's important that the House notes that there are two issues at stake here. One is the investigation about what ministers were told and when. The second is the broader inquiry into how the information came to be released in the way that it was. Those are two separate investigations, and that, as for what's in the letter, it could well be in the letter.
Speaker.
Speaking further to the point of order.
The effective answer from the Prime Minister again opens the prospect that there has been some kind of crime committed that would be punishable under the Crimes Act. Neither of the investigations are looking into that matter. And it will not, it won't, there's no way that there can be any decision or conclusion around that, given the public now agreement by the agencies about what happened and our own knowledge in the opposition of how it was occurred. If that suggestion were to stand from the Prime Minister, then the Prime Minister is condemning every New Zealander who goes on to Google and uses a search bar today the potential allegation that they are behaving in a criminal manner.
Okay. Just want to work through this one, you know, relatively carefully, because I think we have a matter of facts and law here. I think there's a degree of acceptance around the facts of what occurred, and I have certainly read a variety of opinions as to what the law is that fits those facts, and therefore I think it is not out of order for the Prime Minister to say it is debatable whether or not a criminal act has taken place. That is order. If the Prime Minister is of the view that it is debatable whether or not a criminal act took place, then it is not out of order for the Prime Minister to say that she thinks it is debatable that a criminal act took place.
The Honourable Tracy Martin.
To the Prime Minister, is she aware of any protocols or outlines about what should take place in circumstances similar to those that took place in this case?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, yes. In an April 2017 protocol assembled by the Leader of the Opposition, then the Minister for Communications, this is what was written. When private and confidential information is released into an unsecured environment, which is what happened with this data breach, the protocols advise that in the event of a data breach, an individual should contact the relevant business of organisation, namely Treasury, and they didn't. And that's why they're caught by 252 and 249 of the Crimes Act.
Does the Prime Minister think it's arguable that a crime was committed? And if so, what is she going to do about it?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, that's a marvellous question. Because a law professor, in a recent opinion here, suggests that there are two breaches, 252 and 249 of the Crimes Act, and one is a 7-year sentence.
Is using Google search a crime now, Prime Minister?
No, that's not a crime, but what is a crime is to 2,000 times try to gain unauthorised access, which was in a $22 million documentary preparation in April 2017, prepared by that Leader of the Opposition, that was meant to be outlawed. but now he's trying to seek refuge in some other scandal.
The Honourable Tracy Martin.
To the Prime Minister, can she confirm that historically its budget documents have always been confidential until released by the Minister of Finance?
Who interjected?
And is she able to report any incidents in the past where similar information has been highlighted by a member of the opposition to a minister particularly in charge?
Point of order.
The Prime Minister has no responsibility for what happened historically.
I think if the Prime Minister has been briefed on a similar case and is comparing this to that, then that is. I'm going to listen really carefully as the question's asked, but it can be brought into order.
To the Prime Minister, can she confirm that historically it has been recognised that all budget documents are confidential until they are released by the Minister of Finance? And is she aware of any circumstance where previously members of this Parliament had been made aware of confidential information and they then took it directly to the Minister responsible?
On behalf of the Prime Minister, I can answer the first part of that question by saying that there have been leaks in the past, by accident apparently in 1985 under Roger Douglas. There was also a Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK was walking into Parliament, and 15 minutes before he gave his budget speech, he was asked, any tax on cigarettes? And he said no, and he got fired for that. So it's a very serious issue. But of the type that member asked right now, there has, to the best of our knowledge, never been such an appalling breach.
Order. The member will stand, withdraw, and apologise.
Which one?
No, that one.
I apologise.
And withdraw. Question number 3, Marama Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Housing and Urban Development. Is he confident current state housing targets are sufficient given the waitlist for state housing?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In 2013, Otago University estimated there were 41,000 New Zealanders homeless and living in severe housing stress. We're dealing with the effects of a housing crisis and massive unmet need. Budget 18 funded 6,400 additional public homes over the next 4 years, an average of 1,600 a year, and we're well on track to exceed this target in the first year. Since 1 November 2017, over 2,000 more families are in public housing, bringing us to the highest number of public housing tenancies since June 2009. I'm confident that our entire housing program, including our public housing build, is ambitious, that we're making progress, and we'll continue to put more families off the State House waiting list into public housing. It will take time to fully ramp up, but we are making very good progress.
Does he agree that the proposed Urban Development and Housing Agency, Kāinga Ora Homes and Communities, should have a mandate to rebuild our public housing stock to meet projected future demand?
Well, Kāinga Ora Homes and Communities, the new Urban Development Authority, will be the home of state housing. It will manage the state house tenancies, of which there are currently about 68,000, and Housing New Zealand's development group will merge with HLC, the people who did Hobsonville Point, and KiwiBuild's procurement operation to manage the entire government build program, including new state houses. As the member knows, this government is ambitious about building as many public homes as we can in the context of a broader housing program focused on increasing affordability and improving the quality of homes.
What work is underway to ensure new state houses are accessible to people with disabilities?
I've asked Housing New Zealand's board to review their whole approach to how well they serve their tenants who have disabilities. And I think they're making great progress. The work is likely to include a commitment to a share of new state homes with universal design standards. Similarly, with the massive retrofit program that Housing New Zealand has underway, there is an opportunity to make modifications for disability access at the same time as improving insulation, putting in modern kitchens and heating.
Does he intend to promote high standards of energy efficiency in the design and build of new public houses?
Well, Mr. Speaker, Housing New Zealand are making great strides in improving the energy efficiency of their homes. They're currently spending $258 million bringing their homes up to the Healthy Homes standards. Housing New Zealand is also working towards Homestar 6 certification for its new builds. This would put it significantly ahead of much of the private residential construction market.
Question number four, the Honourable Amy Adams.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does he accept that clause 3.27 of the Cabinet Manual states he is individually accountable for the Treasury's actions in relation to the early release of Budget 2019 information, and at what specific time did the Treasury first receive advice from the GCSB relating to the use of the term hack?
Mr. Speaker, I disagree with the member's characterisation of clause 3.27 of the Cabinet Manual. In answer to the second part of the question, that is a matter that is part of the State Services Commissioner's investigation that is currently underway, and I do not believe that it is in the public interest to comment further on those matters.
Why did the Treasury allege its website was systematically and deliberately hacked in an 8 p.m. press statement on Tuesday, when it is already information in the public domain that the Treasury had been advised by the GCSB approximately 2 hours before that at 6 p.m. that the website had not been compromised and there was no hack?
Mr. Speaker, I am not aware of the facts the member states there, but regardless, they are the subject of the State Services Commission inquiry.
What exactly did the Treasury Secretary tell the Minister the GCSB advice had been on this matter when the Minister met with the Secretary prior to releasing his 8:18 p.m. statement?
Mr. Speaker, again, I'm not going to go into the detail of those matters today because they are the subject of the inquiry. What I can do is quote from the Treasury's media statement on Tuesday night, where they said the Treasury has referred the matter to the police on the advice of the National Cyber Security Centre.
Why does he think it is good enough to refuse to answer questions in this House as to the advice the Treasury gave him when he has told the public and this House repeatedly that he relied entirely on that advice before making his statement, and now he won't tell us what it was?
Because, Mr. Speaker, the State Services Commission is undertaking an investigation which the opposition called for. Now that that investigation is underway, it is not appropriate for me as a minister to speculate further on those matters. I am sure once the investigation is over, I'll have the opportunity to say a lot more.
What steps did he or his office take to ensure the Treasury Secretary was aware of the GCSB advice that there had been no hacking before the Secretary's Wednesday morning television appearances?
Mr. Speaker, again, we are in the middle of matters that are part of the investigation. It is not in the public interest for me to comment on those. An investigation that the opposition asked to be undertaken, and I would hope that they would respect an investigation like that. A faint hope, it appears.
Point of order.
A point of order, the Honourable.
Mr. Speaker, by point of order, we traversed these matters in some detail yesterday around the extent of the State Services Commission investigation, that it explicitly is not looking into the actions of ministers. This question was very specifically what the minister or his office had done, not what the officials were done. It is that same area we traversed yesterday, and I would ask the minister to answer the question, because it is not explicitly is not part of the SSC investigation.
Well, I disagree, because my view is that the breadth of the inquiry that is ongoing does in fact cover the Minister's office.
Point. Well, could the Minister then not be directed to address the question in respect of his actions, if that is your ruling in respect to staff?
Well, if,
The short answer is no, because what we get to is what I've indicated before. What the minister did mightn't be covered, but the receiver of the information, if it's anyone other than a minister, and the giver of the information to the minister are both covered if they're not ministers. The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
I can ask the minister as to whether it's possible that his department's mistake was not to look for the obvious culprit in the first place.
Mr. Speaker, again, I'll leave those matters to other people to investigate. But the one thing I can say with absolute certainty is that the period of time which seems to be concerning the opposition so much, Wednesday last week, there was a person who could have cleared the whole thing up, and that person, Simon Bridges, and he didn't do it.
Why did he permit the chief executive of the agency that he is responsible for to state publicly on Wednesday morning that the Treasury system had been hacked, it had been attacked, and further that the material accessed was never on the Treasury website, when all of those statements are now known to be patently incorrect?
Mr. Speaker, I reject the premise of that member's question.
Order, order, both of you. Question number five, the Honourable Michael Wardhouse. Order, Amy Adams will stand up, withdraw and apologise.
Withdraw and apologise.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. Does he stand by all of his statements and actions around Vote Health in Budget 2019?
Mr. Speaker, yes. And in particular, I stand by my statement that with the wellbeing budget, this government is taking mental health seriously, and at the same time investing $1.7 billion in hospitals and other health facilities.
Does he stand by his assertion to the Health Select Committee this morning that a 1.1% increase in Pharmac funding is enough to deliver appropriate access to medicines for New Zealanders?
Mr. Speaker, the member uses his own words rather than mine, but I do stand by the statement that last year over 100,000 New Zealanders gained further access to medicines through the broadening of availability and so on. So that is a lot of people helped by Pharmac's, the Pharmac model last year. On top of that, of course, we've invested $40 million extra in the current budget to further increase access to medicines for New Zealanders.
Would he agree that an increase in Pharmac funding above the just 1.1% appropriated would mean considerably more New Zealanders would be able to access life-saving drugs? And if so, why was there an increase of just 1.1% in this year's wellbeing budget?
Mr. Speaker, of course, everybody in this House will acknowledge that health got a considerable chunk of the wellbeing budget, because mental health in particular was prioritised, and also the long-standing underfunding of DHBs was prioritised so that people can access services in our DHBs. $2.8 billion over 4 years. These are the trade-offs that we make when we put a budget together, as any government does. And in this budget, we decided to invest further in Pharmac, and we did invest $40 million further over 4 years, meaning more access to more medicines. Of course, it is logical that the more money you put in, the more benefit that can be derived. But I would say that Pharmac is very clear that the list of medicines it has, it is prioritising those top medicines which will bring the most value to New Zealanders.
Which one of his statements to the committee this morning is correct? That elective surgery number as at the end of March is not a good proxy of full year throughput because of a rush of sorts that occurs in the last quarter? Or that DHBs won't achieve their budgeted elective surgery figures due to industrial action?
Mr. Speaker, I reject the member's characterisation of my comments again in Select Committee this morning. There is an upturn in elective surgery outputs typically in any given year in the DHB's performance, and they are working currently to deliver to the contracted volumes. Of course, we acknowledge that with interruptions with industrial action, because those staff working in hospitals have been underfunded for so long, that it did disrupt planned care during the course of the year. Fortunately, those things have been settled. We have a nurses' settlement, for example, that is worth more than the last three settlements combined that were done under the previous government. More than the last three settlements combined. That historic underfunding is being addressed. Those professions, those health professions, are now more attractive to join and be a part of. We are determined to invest to make sure that the systemic underfunding that happened for so long does not destroy our health system, because we believe in public health services available and accessible to more New Zealanders.
Now, before the member has the supplementary, we're going way back early in that supplementary answer. The Honourable Ruth Dyson made an unparliamentary interjection. She will stand, withdraw and apologise.
I withdraw and apologise.
Given the Minister's reference to attractive professions, why, given the Ministry of Health had to apologise for their failure to prepare a 2018 budget bid for community midwives, given their obligation to do so, was a 2019 budget bid to reflect the co-design recommendations not made?
Mr. Speaker, this government has continued to lift the fees available to midwives, recognising that a long period of underinvestment does put in jeopardy the sustainability of the midwifery workforce. Last budget, it was an 8.9% uplift in fees for midwives. This budget, an uplift of 4.93%. And that is without the additional wraparound material in the midwives package, because we recognise that we do need to fund this service sustainably to ensure the safety of both mother and midwife and child. And Mr. Speaker, we're proud to be investing more in our midwives, and we recognise that that has been a long time coming.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Point of order, the Honourable Mike.
The question which was not addressed was a budget bid to reflect the agreed co-design process, and the Minister did not address that part of the question.
That's a fair comment. He will address it.
Mr. Speaker, there was a co-design process which happened under the previous government. The Director General of Health has written to the College of Midwives apologising for the way in which that played out. My view, it was a very messy process because of how their last government ran it. That is their failure. He's trying to weaponise the incompetence of his own caucus.
Isn't it true that he and his Labor colleagues in government haven't delivered on their promises in Budget 2019, particularly in the area of medicines, cancer care, elective surgery and community midwifery?
Mr. Speaker, absolutely not.
Question number six, Willow Jean Prime.
Tēnā koe. My question is for the Minister of Finance. What reactions has he seen to Budget 2019?
Speaker, more good news. One school principal wrote to me to say, quote, "As a citizen of Aotearoa, I want a budget that is driven by values that result in a quality life for every person who lives here." She said for her school, the most that the school has ever received in donations in a year had been $2,000. But with the policy change in this budget, her school will now be better off by $40,000. She went on to say, Mr. Speaker, so much in the budget will start to move us as a country to a more equitable, compassionate, respectful, tolerant and rich, in the widest sense of the word, society.
Supplementary. What responses to the budget has he seen in international media?
Mr. Speaker, American author and Bloomberg columnist Cass Sunstein said that New Zealand's wellbeing budget is worth copying. He noted, quote, "New Zealand has taken an important step in the right direction. Other nations should follow its lead." Mr. Speaker, I agree with Mr. Sunstein. This is indeed an ambitious budget. It represents a step towards the budget representing a comprehensive assessment of New Zealand's overall wellbeing and our plans to improve that.
Supplementary. What other responses has he seen to the wellbeing budget?
Well, Mr. Speaker, Business New Zealand Chief Executive Kirk Hope said that the budget's focus on innovation, research and skills would help more businesses develop at higher levels and grow the economy. He said investment in equipping young people with civics knowledge, financial literacy and key workplace competencies was also important for business. Likewise, Brett O'Reilly, Chief Executive of the Manufacturers Network, says the announcement of $6.8 million over 4 years to future-proof New Zealand's manufacturing industry will help members understand and utilise digital technologies in order to be more productive and develop new products and services. I've even seen feedback from one commentator who said, don't get me wrong, there are a few things in the budget I can wholeheartedly support. A rare sign of positivity from Simon Bridges.
Question number 7, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Transport. How much more money is expected to be raised over the three financial years, 2018-19 to 2020-21, as a result of increases in fuel excise duty and accompanying increases in road user charges? And how much money is the Auckland Regional Fuel Tax expected to raise over three financial years, 2018-19 to 2020-21?
The Honourable Phil Twyford. Mr. Speaker. The increase in fuel excise and road user charges is funding road safety improvements to save lives and much needed infrastructure to get our cities and regions moving. Auckland Council's regional fuel tax is funding roads that are vital to support urban growth and public transport that is giving people real choice and helping to unlock Auckland's potential. Over the 3-year period, I'm advised the increase in fuel excise and road user charges is expected to raise $1.056 billion, and the regional fuel tax will raise $450 million.
Supplementary, does he realise that in Auckland, the fuel tax rises amount to nearly $2,000 per household?
Well, the best advice that I have from the Ministry of Transport is that all three rises together in Auckland will cost families $2.50 a week all up, lowest income families only $1.24 a week. And we are, of course, as a government, always looking to ease the cost of living. That's why our government is making over 384,000 lower and middle income New Zealand households an average of $75 a week better off because of the family package. We've increased the minimum wage to $17.70 an hour, giving 209,000 people a much-needed pay rise. We've passed legislation to enable the Commerce Commission to investigate anti-competitive conduct in the retail fuel market.
That's supplementary. Does he understand the frustration of motorists who are being told they should pay more than $1.5 billion more in fuel taxes, and the only thing they can look forward to is lower speed limits?
No, the message that I get back from Auckland motorists is that they at last have a government that's willing to do something about fixing the chronic congestion that over 9 years brought our country's biggest city to a halt and is causing the city to lose $1.3 billion a year in lost productivity. Aucklanders just want us to get on with fixing the problem, and that's what we're doing.
When he agreed with the Honourable Julianne Genta's question yesterday, quote, can he confirm that the best way to invest in capacity for our motorway networks is to invest in the complementary alternatives, end quote, did he understand that he was in effect agreeing that the best way to invest in the capacity for our motorway networks is not to invest in our motorway networks?
Well, I invite the member to consider the case of the Northern Busway, which currently now brings in as many people into the central city every morning on the bus as travel by car. A relatively cheap bit of transport infrastructure put in place under the Clark Labor government has meant that the Auckland Harbour Bridge moves relatively freely every morning, and the country has been spared the expense of multiple billions of dollars for an additional harbour crossing that would have had to have happened several years ago now without State Highway 1 jamming up completely. The best way to get better productivity out of the existing motorway network is to have rapid transit and public transport running alongside it.
Kieran McInulty.
To the Minister, what reports has he seen on claims of how much revenue these increases will raise?
Mr. Speaker, I note that the number Mr. Paul Goldsmith used yesterday in the House on this issue and the number that the Leader of the Opposition has been using this morning, $1.5 billion, not including the regional fuel tax, is off by $450 million. And I think it's disappointing that...
I'm also disappointed that the approach taken by the supplementary question. The member, in fact, members know that that is out of order, to do a supplementary question of that type for the sole purpose of bringing up something that the minister is not responsible for.
Supplementary.
There's a warning.
How can he say, as he did yesterday, that his government brings a balanced approach to transport when it is refusing to build any major new roads in the next 3 years?
Well, if we take the Auckland example, we are currently completing the improvements in the Southern Corridor, State Highway 1, the upgraded Takanini Interchange, the Lincoln to Westgate project on State Highway 16. There's a long list of roading projects that we're building. It's just that we're not a government that believes only roads and motorways are worth investing in. We believe in a truly multimodal transport system. And, Mr. Speaker, that is the definition of a balanced transport policy.
Supplementary. So 20 months into government, does he have any timetable about when work would start on light rail down Dominion Road?
Well, as the member knows, it's a multi-billion dollar rapid transit project. We're determined to take the time to get it right. But what distinguishes this government from that government is that we are actually investing in rapid transit to get our cities moving.
Mr. Speaker.
I can anticipate this one.
It's
a different one. Yeah. Way go.
I could go. Point of order, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to seek leave to table a letter. First of all, just wanted to apologise for doing it now and not at the end of question four, but I had to get the letter to check the wording of it. I seek leave to table a letter from the State Services Commission dated the 10th of June from Mr. Hughes about the investigation and that it relates specifically to Mr. McLoof and his actions and statements, and think it might help the House tomorrow if we're still going down the line of questioning that we have been today.
Is there any objection to that letter being tabled? There appears to be none.
Thank you.
It will be tabled and I'll look at it very soon, I hope. Further supplementary, Mr. Goldsmith. Question number 8, Denise Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Housing and Urban Development, is he confident he is meeting the Prime Minister's expectations around openness and transparency?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Yes.
Did he meet with the Mayor of Auckland, Phil Goff, and the Minister for the Environment, David Parker, on the 2nd of March 2019 to discuss the Auckland rural urban boundary?
Yes.
Why, when his and Minister Parker's diaries were released, did Minister Parker reveal the meeting but he did not?
The meeting was in my diary, but there was an error in the published diary where it wasn't transferred over.
Order.
It was an oversight that has since been corrected.
Is it correct, as was asserted in emails released to me from Minister Parker's office, that he requested, quote, a political meeting with no officials, unquote, with Mayor Goff and Minister Parker to discuss the Auckland rural urban boundary?
If I could just seek clarification from the member. Is the member asking me, is it correct that Minister Parker requested a political meeting with no officials present? Was that the question?
That's exactly what the question was. A little bit extra.
May I clarify, Mr. Speaker? I am asking for his confirmation that emails released to me from Minister Parker's diary show that he, Minister Twyford, requested a meeting with no political...
I got it wrong. Is that accurate?
I had requested a meeting with no officials present.
What does the non-disclosure by a minister of a meeting with another minister and the mayor of New Zealand's largest city about arguably the most important factor impacting on the supply and cost of housing say about this government's commitment to openness and transparency?
Well, as I said, Mr. Speaker, as soon as the error was pointed out to me that the matter hadn't been transferred over to the published diary, it was corrected.
Point of order.
A point of order, Denise Lee.
I seek leave to table an email from Minister Twyford's office requesting a meeting with the Mayor of Auckland to discuss the rural-urban boundary that states it is to be a political meeting with no officials in attendance.
Can you tell me the source of that email? Where did you get it? Where did
an Official Information Act request. Oh, it is not publicly available.
I mean, it clearly is publicly available if it's been released under the Official Information Act. Now, only to the member? Only to the member, is not as part of the rest of the process. OK. Any objection to that being tabled? Appears to be none. Question number 9, Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Okay, Fari.
Greetings, Mr. Speaker.
My question is to the Minister of Housing and Urban Development. How many state houses are under construction in June 2019, and how does this compare to June 2016?
Mr. Speaker, I'm advised that Housing New Zealand at the moment has 2,700 homes contracted and under construction, with a further 5,236 state homes in the planning and procurement process to be delivered between now and 2021-22. This is a ninefold increase on the 222 homes under construction in June 2016.
Supplementary, where are these homes being built?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the changes that were made in Budget 2018 meant that Housing New Zealand could start building on the considerable reserves of vacant land in regional New Zealand that we saw build up over the last 9 years. 900 homes are currently being built in regional centres, predominantly on this vacant land. Significant numbers of new state housing are being built in regional New Zealand for the first time in decades.
How will Housing New Zealand continue to increase the scale of its build program?
Well, Mr. Speaker, Housing New Zealand is moving to multi-year capacity contracts with builders and away from project-by-project contracts. This is where Housing New Zealand guarantees a minimum amount of building every year. This contracting arrangement gives builders the certainty to invest in their business. It lays the platform to use more off-site manufacturing to take on more apprentices and reduce the cost of construction.
The Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So does he stand by the statements of Housing New Zealand Chief Executive Andrew McKenzie, who told the Social Services and Community Committee on 20 February this year that most of the State House new builds in 2017-18 were consented or started under the previous National-led government?
Well, I think in the months following a general election, you would assume logically that most of the houses that had been built at that stage had been consented a few months prior to the election. But, Mr. Speaker, I repeat, the number of homes that Housing New Zealand has under construction right now represents a ninefold increase on what was being done in 2016. Ninefold increase.
Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
What benefits has the increased scale of the build program already had?
Mr. Speaker, the form of contracting with doing multi-year deals with large builders and developers has enabled Housing New Zealand to reduce the labour costs of new builds by 15%. Off-site manufacturing has already reduced the build time of Housing New Zealand's developments down from 14 to 18 months down to 4.5 months.
A point of order, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to table a document compiled by the Library from a number of different sources, including written parliamentary questions, oral ones, OIA responses from Housing New Zealand and other documents showing the number of state houses built by Housing New Zealand from 1999 through to 2018, year by year.
Is there any objection of that document being tabled? There appears to be none. Question number 10, Todd Muller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Climate Change. Does he stand by his statement in relation to New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions, and I quote, "We're estimating that they will peak sometime in the mid-2020s and decline from that point on? End quote. And by what year does he expect greenhouse gas emissions will peak under this government's policies?
The Honourable James Shaw.
Mr Speaker, in response to the first part of the question, yes. That statement was based on greenhouse gas emissions projections in New Zealand's third biennial report, reflecting the policies that were in place in July of 2017. In answer to the second part of the question, New Zealand's fourth biennial report will be published in December of this year and will include revised projections reflecting the policies that are in place under this government.
Point of order.
A point of order, Todd Muller.
To the Mr Speaker, I have a question on notice where I specifically asked the year in which greenhouse gases will peak. The Minister made a reference.
I'm sorry, I was temporarily diverted. I will ask the Minister to give the second part of his question again, and if he didn't address the second part of the member's question, he will.
Well, in response to the second part of the question, New Zealand's fourth biennial report will be published in December of this year and will include revised projections reflecting the policies that are in place under this government. So I cannot give him a year in which we're projecting the policies of this government to manage peaking. I can only give him the year that we have the most recent data for, which is the third biennial report, which is the answer to the first part of the question.
Supplementary. Taking your Radio New Zealand, the Minister's Radio New Zealand comments then, around mid-2020s, why can he not commit to reducing emissions until 2025, mid-2020s, given the government's promise, and I quote, to urgently reduce New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, Mr Speaker, my comments on Radio New Zealand reflected the most recent biennial report that we had, which was the third biennial report, which reflects policies that were in place in July of 2017. The entire work program of this government in relation to climate change is intended to accelerate the peaking and decline of emissions in this country. It includes things, for example, setting up an independent climate change institution, reforming the emissions trading scheme, planting a billion trees, developing a renewable energy strategy, heat and industrial processes work under the ECA fund, transport emissions, putting $14.5 billion into heavy rail, light rail, walking and cycling over the course of the next 10 years, dramatically unlocking the transport in Auckland and Wellington and so on. So if you know, add up all of those policies, we'll be able to give him a year in which we can actually project the decline in the fourth biennial report in December of this year.
Supplementary. To the Minister, why has he, on the one hand, actively encouraged school children to strike for urgent action on climate change, but on the other hand, giving himself 6-7 years from the time he became Minister until New Zealand's emissions start declining?
I have not. I mean, as I said, my comments on Radio New Zealand reflected the policies of the previous government, which is the year that we had the third biennial report for. And the reason why I support people who are taking to the streets to protest the lack of action over the course of the past 30 years in relation to their future is because it is the single most important thing that they are facing. I think that that is up to them.
Supplementary. To the Minister, why is he video conferencing into council boardrooms around the country, urging them to declare climate emergencies, while at the same time overseeing emissions that he has just said intend to peak into, and I quote, the mid-2020s?
Because video conferencing is lower emissions than flying there in person.
To the Minister, isn't this yet another example of the government failing to deliver on its promise and on all issues, the nuclear-free generation moment?
No, Mr. Speaker, as I said in answer to the first, to the primary question and to the supplementary, the data that we have is the third biennial report that reflects the policies that were in place under the previous government. We will have new projections, which I am hoping will show that we will peak our emissions sooner as a result of the increased... those will come through in December in response to your question. You'll be happy to see that when that gets published. And I think that the policies of this government will show that we will peak emissions earlier than the policies of the previous government.
Question number 11, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Associate Minister of Transport, does she stand by all of her statements, policies and actions on road safety?
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Julianne Genta.
Yes, in particular, I stand by this government's balanced approach to road safety that includes the largest ever investment program in road safety upgrades, including $1.4 billion over 3 years to upgrade thousands of kilometres of roads, increased funding for road police, and targeted speed reductions.
Supplementary. Does she stand by her comment yesterday in relation to the $331 million Vote Police Road Safety Program appropriation? Quote, the figure used by the police is simply a placeholder figure only, and how many other placeholder figures are there in Vote Transport or Vote Police in Budget 2019?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I stand by that statement, and I'll explain to the member again that the 2018 to 2021 Road Safety Partnership Program includes $1.045 billion in funding for road policing, with $352.7 million in funding already approved for 2018-2019. This three-year funding represents an increase of $85 million above the investment level in the previous national government's road policing program. And we are yet, NZTA and police are finalizing the details of the road safety policing program. Because we've had this increased focus on road safety, we are looking to ensure that we have the right level of investment, that we have the most effective approach to reducing deaths and serious injuries on our roads.
Supplementary, well, given that, why is the Vote Police Road Safety Program not listed as a fiscal risk in the budget?
I think that if the member puts that down in writing, we might be able to address that. It really is a question for the Minister of Finance. But what I can say, that it's not a fiscal risk because we've already approved the funding from the NLTF in Vote Transport. Higher than the level that.
Supplementary. Why have safety upgrades for State Highway 58, described by NZTA as Wellington's most dangerous road, been delayed?
What the NZTA is currently in the process of doing is identifying the road safety upgrades and improvements that will make the greatest effect in terms of reducing deaths and serious injuries across the entire country. And therefore, the prioritization of projects is aimed at reducing deaths and serious injuries right across the country. No.
Supplementary.
We will save more lives than you.
Order. Order. The member's going to have another chance to finish or to give another answer. She should wait until it's her turn. Chris Bishop.
Is it correct she threatened to resign if the Let's Get Wellington Moving project included a commitment to a second Mount Victoria tunnel ahead of mass rapid transit?
No.
Question number 12, Anahila Kanongataha Sui Suiki.
Kia ora te mana whakawā. He pātai.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Education.
About support for Pacific learners and their whānau.
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Jenny Salisa.
This year's wellbeing budget makes lifting Pacific income, skills and opportunities one of our top priorities. That's why I was proud to announce $27.4 million in Budget 2019 to support a package of initiatives focused on achieving Pacific outcomes, growing cultural competency of the workforce and providing opportunities for our students to learn in Pacific languages. This funding for Pacific education is just part of the $113 million specifically targeting to lift the skills and outcomes of Pacific people in New Zealand. It is a clear demonstration of our government's commitment to lifting the well-being of New Zealanders.
Pātai Tāpiri.
Parliamentary question.
How will this engage young Pacific learners?
Mr Speaker, what we know from talking to Pacific students is that a great teacher is someone who understands just how important their identity, culture and language is and shows respect in ways as simple as pronouncing their names correctly. To support the thousands of Pacific New Zealand students who make up 13% of all school-aged children aged between 5 to 18 year olds, we will expand funding Tapasā, which is a cultural competency framework for teachers of Pacific students. There is currently a huge demand for Tapasā from teachers of our Pacific learners because, like us, they understand that Pacific learners who feel respected and are encouraged to have high aspirations achieve better educational outcomes.
Will this fund?
Mr Speaker, this historical increase in funding for Pacific education will allow the continuation and expansion of successful initiatives with proven track record. Tapasā is just one of those initiatives. We're also supporting extending the Pacific Early Literacy Project, implementing DIMIC, which is developing mathematical communities of inquiry in many more schools, enhancing and implementing initiatives to support Pacific families, Pacific parents, communities and Pacific learners, and support for Pacific bilingual education. This government knows that it's important to have community-driven initiatives, and we know that we actually need to expand and fund these initiatives, unlike the last government.
That concludes oral questions.